Forward Guidance is brought to you by Van Eck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about Van Eck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. Very pleased to welcome back to Forward Guidance, Vincent Deluard, Head of Global Macro at StoneX. Vincent, great to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Super happy to be here again.
Vincent, I know you've got a lot of thoughts on inflation, the long-term debt cycles, financial repression, as well as you've got some pretty bold calls on recession risk in the U.S. But first, Vincent, I really want to start off with your thoughts on China, because what's going on there is so important. You started one of your recent reports with an analogy to the 16th century about how the discovery of silver in, I don't know if it was Latin America or Europe, caused a huge inflationary crisis in China. And you write that 480 years later, the Chinese Communist Party is running a similarly dangerous experiment by maintaining a fixed exchange rate with the New World. Explain what you meant by that.
As you know, I love financial history, so I'm going to start with the conquistadores, and then we'll work our way to the Communist Party. So what I was referring to was the discovery of the Potosi mine in Bolivia. You know, the Spaniards were looking for El Dorado, the golden land, and what they found instead was a huge silver mountain in the Andes in Bolivia. And I think at one point produced 90% of world silver production for a century. They built a town up there. It was incredible. And what was interesting is that at the time you had this bimetallic standard between gold and silver in China, and the exchange rate in China was not the same as in Europe. So as the silver flowed back on the Spanish galleons, the price of silver crashed in Europe, and you can just arbitrage it, basically sell silver for gold in Shanghai in China, ship it back to Europe, get it back into gold, get the gold back into silver in Spain, and then do it again. You even need to go for the Potosi mine at the end. You were just emptying the Chinese coffer. And that presumably is one of the big reasons for the decline of the Ming dynasty and eventually the Qing and then the fall of the Chinese Empire. That's really when it started to go down for them. So I was bringing that up as an illustration of the peril of running a fixed exchange rate, which is basically what the Chinese were doing with this fixed 1-to-6 ratio between gold and silver, when you have an outside external shock. In a way, I think the discovery of modern monetary theory after COVID in the U.S. and the realization that, yeah, we can run the economy hotter and we can have high growth, high inflation for a long time, creates a similar risk for China, which is pegging now to the dollar at a time when that, basically, if you're going to peg the currency, more or less you're going to have to import the monetary policy. I mean, you can vary a little bit with capital controls, but if you have a situation like where we are today, when the entire Chinese yield curve is about 2-3% below the U.S., capital is going to start leaking in the same way that the gold from the Ming treasure ended up in Sevilla and Madrid. So the traditional economic remedy is let the prices float, let markets do their thing, because all that you're doing when you're fighting it is emptying your treasurer and you'll end up losing against speculators. So that was the analogy. And the conclusion from that analogy is that China should just get on with it, accept that its equilibrium rate now is lower than that of the U.S. and let the yuan settle where it needs to be, where the market would have it, which probably around 9 instead of 7.2. That's the classical analysis. I'm not sure I fully agree with it, but that's the framework.
So the discovery of silver in the 16th century in Bolivia, when silver at the time was basically money, that led to a lot of problems for China back in the day. Now you're saying the discovery of modern monetary theory, basically the U.S. government printing debt, which is now, you know, a form of money, that is causing similar issues. So is the way that a Chinese devaluation, how would that help fix the Chinese issue?
Well, let me first be a bit more specific. Not so much a discovery of debt, because we've had it for a long time, but the discovery that we can run the economy harder, I think it is really the, and we'll get back, I'm sure, in the second part of the conversation. But for those who, you know, haven't heard our previous discussion, my basic framework since COVID really is that of the Great Reset. That in the U.S., we kind of shackled our way in a way in the 2010s with the 2% target and with fiscal austerity. And through COVID, we broke this shackle and we're resetting to a world where we're going to have, I mean, I'm going to throw some numbers. They may or may not be right, but my guess is 4% inflation and 2 to 3% growth sustainably without recessions. So what does that mean? That means, you know, yields are too low and we are in a process where yields are trying to catch up. So in this world, yeah, if you have like 6-7% nominal growth, your neutral rate is far above 5%. And I think that's the pressure that we're seeing is the U.S. rates come up. And the rest of the world is in a bind. You see the Japanese with the yen crashing, and the Chinese are trying to keep up with that because they want to maintain the yuan as a store of value. And so they're keeping the exchange rate. I mean, you look at basically 7.2, 7.3 is where it's at. And the question is, how long can you keep doing that when your own internal dynamic is going the other way? Maybe 10 years ago, the neutral rate was higher in China. China had higher growth, China had higher productivity, China had higher inflation. And now it's the exact opposite, right? China has basically no inflation, shrinking labor force, and a huge debt hangover. So the traditional cure for that would be indeed to lower interest rates and as a result, allow the exchange rate to depreciate. The idea is also that depreciation helps boost the economy because it makes your export more competitive. At a time when your other sources of growth, like, you know, bank credit is going to be weak because your banks are deleveraging, consumption is going to be weak. So you really need that boost. This is basically an analysis that, in hindsight, people applied to Japan after 89. So if you remember in the 80s, Japan is having this fantastic bubble. We get the Plaza Accord. When the dollar was too strong, when basically Reagan twisted the arms of the Japanese and the Germans, say, hey, you need to revalue the yuan, the yen and Deutschmark, which they did. Then Japan had this massive bubble, internal bubble. The yen went way too high, and it took them 20 years to get out of it, if at all, because the yen was too strong and the economy never recovered. So the idea is we don't want the Chinese who've studied this because they were watching from across the Sea of Japan. One probably should want to avoid making the same mistake and allow devaluation of the yuan. I'm not, again, this is the standard economic textbook. And in the piece that I shared, I suggested some ideas as to why I don't think it's going to play out that way.
So Japan's mistake was strengthening the yen in 1985 at the request of the United States. So now you think, you know, there is the argument to be made that China should devalue the Chinese yuan in order to stimulate exports, right. As you said. Russell Napier came on board guidance and made exactly that argument. So why do you think that China won't devalue its yen, even though it should, but you think maybe it won't?
Right. By the way, I love that episode with Russell. I mean, Russell is one of these guys that, I mean, I wish he would, I don't know him personally, but every time I listen to him, I hit replay, I take notes. I mean, fantastic guy. And I mean, he's been right on so many things. On this one, I mean, I think his policy prescription is probably right. His historical analog is also right. I mean, I think, you know, Russell's perspective is very much that of a historian, which I love. So he's looking at, you know, the US in the 1930s, Japan in the 1980s. And you see this very similar pattern, right? High growth, big export, then growth slows. So I see the analog, but I also see a couple differences. One is one of size. I mean, China is just a beast, you know. And when you hear people compare, China is in the same position as Thailand in 1997, it's like, I mean, a couple of speculators could break the Bank of Thailand. The People's Bank of China has $3 trillion in reserves. The capital flight, yes, there is some, but it's nothing like Thailand when it was so easily. I mean, you could arbitrage all this stuff. I mean, you know, because you could just borrow in baht, invest in dollar, make, I mean, it was so easy. And I think the Chinese have kept much greater control over their banking sector. And also the economic specialization. So the reason why it worked in Thailand, eventually after tremendous pain, was because they were competing for low cost commoditized good, right? I mean, garments, things like that. So, I mean, getting the Thai baht lower really helped them. China, I mean, who's competing with China at this point? I mean, if you look at the EVs, they probably had now a 80% market share, smartphone, 50% market share, solar panel, you name it. So, I think that's one problem that comes up when we say, oh, let's sanction China. It's like, well, who are you going to buy from? I mean, we don't make this stuff anywhere. So it's not clear that China has a price competitiveness problem. The other thing that China has that these countries did not have was a large current account surplus. I mean, you almost have, I think it's around $900 billion annual current account surplus. So say, okay, you want to devalue while you have a big current account surplus? I mean, how does that make sense? And then finally, this is an argument that Michael Pettis, who is also one of the smartest guys on China I know, makes. The basic problem in China is one of an outside export sector and an undersized consumption sector. Like consumption as a share of GDP is 50% in China. It's probably around 80% in the US. So that kind of export-driven model that China has had since the reforms in the early 90s can't work mathematically. Like China now is 12% of the world's exports. I mean, they keep doing this, it'll be 100%. So what you need is to boost consumption and the private sector more so than investment and exports. And devaluation does the exact opposite, right? Devaluation is effectively a transfer from the domestic sector, which has less money, like because the currency is worth less, to the export sector, which has more money because they earn foreign currency, which is worth more. So that would be the exact wrong policy from that standpoint. And then the last one, which I'll just mention, but we can talk about it later, is an argument that my friend Louis Vincent of GAFCAL makes, which is, I think it's ultimately the most powerful because it's about politics. And I think the decision to devalue the yuan would go against everything that China and Xi Jinping especially have been doing for the past 15, 20 years. And I think we're making a mistake by thinking that, you know, they're obsessed with GDP. And no, they have a higher strategic goal. And that, I think the supreme goal of China is achieve full sovereignty. And the way you do that is by being able to buy your own commodities in your own currency. And to do that, you don't devalue the currency if you're trying to convince other people to accept it as a means of payment. So I think for them, the juice is worth the squeeze.
So if China won't devalue the yuan, does that mean that there's going to be a recession or an economic slowdown in China? Because the people who say that China needs to devalue the yuan, they say it because the Chinese economy is struggling and it needs a reflationary boost, a stimulation to the economy. Without that, why would China not go to the recession? What do you think?
TBD. You know, like they haven't devalued yet. They're not in recession. I mean, last time I checked, the GDP grew 5% in Q1. So when they reopened, everybody expected them to stimulate demand and they didn't do that. And they had their reason. I think that the reason she's correctly see the biggest risk to China is to do more of the same. More of, you know, building bridges to nowhere and infrastructure. And I mean, you go there, you see the infrastructure is world-class. I mean, but, you know, it's mostly done. Or, you know, extending credit and making bad loans. So what they thought, which was pretty smart, is we're going to stimulate the supply side of the economy. We're going to make industrial loans and we're going to take the lead in what was called the three news at the time, EVs, batteries, solar panel. Because they could see at the same time both Europe and the US making these insane climate change targets, where you know that you would need like more batteries than the world ever produced just for England. So like, okay, we'll build them, and that worked. You know, exports really picked up in 2023, and that saved China from a recession. So could things change? Surely, I mean, if we have a Trump administration, you know, we might see more protectionism. But for now, I don't think China is at immediate risk of falling into recession. So they might keep it. And then maybe something else will happen. Maybe we'll have a major war between NATO and Russia. Maybe we'll have escalation between Iran and Israel. So maybe we'll have other things on our mind than the bilateral trade deficit between the US and China.
So China has had the biggest real estate bubble in history. It's kind of a man-made intentional implosion of that by China, the Communist Chinese Party, and you know the three red lines. It's directing banks to stop lending or to slow down their lending to Chinese real estate developers. And you know, Evergrande has gone bankrupt. Several other developers are on the brink of bankruptcy or already have entered default. And the Chinese argument is, okay, we're taking that credit and we're redirecting it to what you said, making electric vehicles, making solar panels, and the like. So I guess the critics of the Chinese economy would say that that's not enough to fill the gap. Sounds like you think it could be.
Again, TBD. One thing, we don't need to fill the full gap. China doesn't need to grow. I mean, the growth rates that we saw in the 2010s, 2000, even like 10% real growth. I mean, China is now an upper middle income country with a shrinking population. So growth rate of 3 to 5% is enough to lift, to achieve most goals, especially if that growth rate is driven by consumption. Like, okay, how good is, achieving 10% growth? Is what you're doing is building a bunch of crappy buildings that are going to collapse in 10 years or bridges that no one's going to use. I mean, it's the quality of growth argument, right? So I don't think we need to fill the full gap. I also think that there is a lot of demand from China that's not coming from the West, not coming from Europe, not coming from the US, that China is probably a lot more excited about its trade with Indonesia, about its investment in the Central Asian countries of the Belt and Road, about the no-limit friendship with Russia. I mean, Russia is blowing up a lot of stuff in Ukraine, and that requires, China is basically refilling that. So I think there are all these avenues for growth. And then there's also the argument we're making earlier is that even if we don't like to trade with China, we don't make the solar panels here anymore. We don't make the batteries. So you see that in Europe, especially this orthogonality between the climate change policy and the trade policy objective, which is like, well, if we want to do the green transition, we're going to have to import a lot more from China because that's where the EVs are.
Final question about China, Vincent, is, are you worried that the huge Chinese investment into producing very low cost electric vehicles, solar panels and the like will cause disinflation or deflation in the rest of the world? I mean, if BYD, China's by far most successful electric vehicle producer, if they can make cars for electric vehicles for $10,000, that's putting a lot of pressure on Tesla, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. In general, deflation is not something I worry about a lot in the US, at least. No, because I think we're gonna tax the hell out of them. We're going to put sanctions.
Tariffs.
Tariffs, sanctions, non-trade restriction. The Americans will be more straightforward about it, especially if we have a Trump president. The Europeans will hide it behind some sort of like carbon tax or labor standard. I mean, all that's hidden protectionism at the end of the day. But I don't really see the U.S. just suddenly, the zeitgeist is toward reindustrialization, right? And we want to move the stuff back from China. We don't want to get more China stuff. Same thing in Europe. I don't see the big European car makers who are already squeezed by Tesla, by Chinese EVs, just lay down and take the punches. So I'm not too worried about it. That being deflationary in Europe or the US. I do think that it will be deflationary. Well, not exactly deflationary. I would say productivity enhancing and growth boosting for emerging markets. So what I mean is I can see that being productivity enhancing for Indonesia, for Peru, for Chile, for Brazil, for Pakistan, because these are countries where, the difference between a $40,000 car and $10,000 car is huge. And if you can get that first car to be an EV, the reason I'm not saying deflationary is because you're reaching someone who did not have a car before. I mean, we think of it as deflationary in the West because we think of it, I'm going to replace my $50,000 Tesla with a $10,000 BYD. But the reality is that how it's going to play out is going to be some Indonesian or Indian customer who is driving a Vespa or two-wheel vehicle that's going to upgrade to an EV, to a Chinese EV, which he couldn't do before. So I don't think that's really necessarily deflationary. It just means that the economy will get more productive.
In 2017, Forward Guidance's exclusive sponsor, VanEck, was the first ETF issuer to file for a Bitcoin-linked ETF. 7 years later, Bitcoin ETFs are finally available. Using the Van Eck Bitcoin Trust ticker HODL, you can invest in Bitcoin with zero fees until March 31st, 2025. That's right, zero fees until March 31st, 2025. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today or visit vaneck.com/HODLFG to learn more. Now, the disclosures. An investment in the Van Eck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL, involves significant risk and may not be suitable for all investors. You could lose your entire investment. The Trust offers fewer investor protections as it is not registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940 or as a commodity pool under the Commodity Exchange Act. For a complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus linked below. You can learn more about HODL and its zero fees until March 31st, 2025 at vaneck.com/HODLFG. That's vaneck.com/HODLFG. And now back to the interview. Now, Vincent, we've taken a nice little tour to China. Let's zoom out and talk about the long-term debt cycle. You write that we could be entering the sudden phase of the debt cycle. So what is the debt cycle? What does it have to do with inflation? Typically, debt cycle, these long-term debt cycles, they go on, you know, 50 years, going back to the 1940s. But you argue that we're entering the sudden phase. What is so sudden about what you think is going to happen?
Oh, you know, it comes from that famous quote from Hemingway, the sun also rises. How do you get bankrupt? Two ways, first slowly and then suddenly. So that's where the rate is for. And yeah, as you mentioned, you have these very long-term cycles. And maybe you can, I don't know if you want me to get into it now or later, but the idea is basically as you have extended periods of peace and prosperity, asset prices, and as a result, debt rise faster than income. And at the beginning, that's okay when debt levels are low, like that everybody's happy, credit expands, blah, blah, blah. But you reach that point when your debt load becomes too large in relation to your income, asset prices become too high in relation to the wages. And then you have basically the bottom of society that's stuck. And I think we're somewhat there. I mean, if you look at the number of hours you need to work to buy a house in the US, for example. And when that happens, you need to do something. You need to basically do two things: increase the price of wages, which inflation does in a way, and reduce the price of asset prices. The real price of asset prices, which we can do with higher rates. I think we've been very slowly moving towards that outcome. We had our first debt crisis on the private sector. So basically, that dynamic I was describing, asset prices rising faster than income, at first was filled with credit card debt and then mortgage debt, right? That's the story of the late 90s, early 2000s. Oh, well, you can't afford it, put it on a credit card or take a home equity loan. And we did that. And for a while, that worked. And then that no longer works. We nationalized that debt with, you know, the TARP and the alphabet letter soup of Fed programs, which basically just meant taking over private liabilities, put them on the public sector balance sheet. And now somehow we have to get rid of it. How do we get rid of it? A mix of QE, we did that a lot, balance sheet expansion, and then a mix of high inflation and high nominal growth. So you grow the denominator. And yeah, the past couple months made me think, oh, wow, what was happening slowly before is happening faster. Like you see three bad inflation print and the Fed is still not doing anything. You see gold, you know, making that triple top and just crushing through it. You see the yen collapsing to 160 overnight. You see Congress just, okay, one day, okay, we're going to cancel student loan debt. Next day, $100 billion to Ukraine and Israel. I mean, I don't know, what are you going to do on Thursday? You know, like you get this feeling that things are accelerating. So that's where that was coming from.
So much there. So when you said that the private debt has been nationalized, in some way that literally occurred, but you know, it wasn't like all of the private debts just went on the government's balance sheet. It was as you know, you're speaking metaphorically, the US ran the government ran a large deficit, i.e. printed a lot of money, printed a lot of debt, and that allowed the private sector to deleverage. So, you know, if you look at the private sector really levered up from, let's say, 1980 to 2007, from 2007 or 2008 until now, it has been private debt as a percentage of the economy stagnated or maybe even going down, but that being replaced by a huge amount of of public debt. And then you make a really important point about inflation and interest rates. And the level of interest rates is basically how much the financial economy is growing, and inflation is how much the real economy is growing. So basically, the financial economy has become so large relative to the real economy over the past 40 years. You're saying that what needs to occur is for the debt to be inflated away. You know, some other folks talk about this as well, and that means having interest rates much lower than the growth level or the inflation level.
Yeah, you can call it financial repression. You can call it negative real rates. And we're there. I mean, I think the Treasury Department publishes that. I think the average cost to service U.S. debt right now is 2.7%. How wonderful is that, isn't it? I mean, because a lot of that is, of course, legacy debt, right? They issued when the rates were really low. So, you know, you service your existing debt at 2.7 and nominal GDP. We can get into the economic discussion later, but in my world, basically, inflation is at 4%, growth is at 2.5%, 3%. And you see that, by the way, from tax collections. That's something I spend a lot of time.
Sorry, but so you think inflation, in your world, inflation is at 4% and growth is at 2%, 2.5%? You mean real growth. So by that, you think nominal growth is 6.5%?
Yeah, 7%.
Yeah, yeah.
So pretty damn good. I mean, you know, you pay 3% on your liability and you're, think of it, you know, if you're a company that your balance sheet is the debt, the liability side, and then the top line is your revenue, tax collection. I mean, if you were to do this analogy, yeah, that's good. And especially when you have about 100% debt of GDP, you know, there's that 5% spread between nominal growth in the economy and what you pay on your liability. So every year you reduce the stock, what actually matters, the stock of debt to GDP by 5%. So we are doing this. We are completing this beautiful debt averaging by keeping servicing costs of debt below nominal GDP.
Right. But in order for that to be true, Vincent, nominal growth has to stay at 6% or above the current level of interest of 5.5%. Because
the 5.5 is a marginal.
I know, but we're getting there. At some point, the cost of debt will approach that 5%.
Yeah.
You said some ridiculously low number. I'm sure that's correct about the average cost on the U.S. debt. That is because the U.S. financed itself when interest rates were so low. Eventually, it's getting up to that 5.5%.
Eventually, but very slowly. Yes. Yep. I mean, I think the duration of U.S. debt is shorter than what it should be. I mean, if I ran the Treasury in 2020, I would have done the 100-year. I would have done a millennium bond, you know, like Austria did or whatever. Like, I think the U.S. really missed an opportunity to save the taxpayer a lot of money by issuing 100-year bond back then.
But listen, so would every macro hedge fund manager. I mean, Stan Druckenmiller made a very similar point, but the U.S. Treasury is not a hedge fund trying to make money for the government. It is, you know, the policy then was to stimulate, and the most stimulative thing was to finance it short-term at low interest rates, right?
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, I agree with that assessment, because at the end of the day, I mean, you know, it's almost like an MMT argument, right? You make the rules, so you're not... You don't have to turn a profit on. You're not running the national debt for profit. I get that. So I was trying to go with the idea that U.S. maturity of U.S. debt is about 7 years, I think. And right now, I mean, we're still issuing long term debt. I mean, not as much as before because of, you know, like short term QRA stuff like that. But so you're really, you know, you're only rolling over 15% of your stock of debt every year. And you're rolling it over on a yield curve that, in my world, is entirely below. The whole yield curve is below the rate of nominal growth. And again, 4% inflation, 2%, 2-3% growth. Fed funds rate, which is the highest point of the yield curve at this point, is 5.5%. So even though the marginal debt is below nominal, you can also see that, as I mentioned, the tax collections, federal tax collections are growing by 9%. So far this year, after April. So that also gives you an idea of where nominal growth might be. So even you're rolling it below, and then also the yield curve is inverted, right? So if you roll it at the longer end, you know, you're probably financing at, you know, closer to like, you know, 4.5, 4.7%. And that just went to 4.7, and you were below 4 not so long ago. Yeah, no, it is still happening, that deleveraging. And I think maybe part of the move of the past month, what was the market realizing, oh, this is what's happening to me. I need to catch up, but we're not caught up yet.
Vincent, you've always, you know, for as long as I've known you, you've always been a massive economic bull. That has obviously been right. There's been no recession in the U.S. and growth has remained solid. You've also been a huge bull on inflation. That obviously was correct too, even though inflation, the rate of inflation has itself fallen down from 9% to, you know, below a little bit below 4%, but still definitely above 2%. But it sounds like, Vincent, you are especially optimistic on U.S. growth now, and maybe a slightly bit more optimistic than you were last time. I believe the last time we spoke, for the first time, you said, you know, maybe there could be a recession. Right. I've always thought there'd be no recession. Maybe there could be a recession. Now, based on your report where you, I mean, I'll get the exact quote, but I mean, the name of your other report is How to Invest for a Recession-Free Future. So you make a very, very bold call. What gives you such confidence to make that call? Because clearly, you know, Vincent, the last thing you want to be is the guy who says, there's never going to be a recession ever in 2007, you know? So what can, you must be pretty confident if you're going to make that report and make that bold call.
Yeah. There's also the non-negligible possibility that I look like a total fool. But no, I actually feel confident enough to take that risk. So why was I worried a little bit last year? It was really a fiscal impulse type of argument because we had so much stimulus in 2023, especially at the state level, that I thought, okay, if you look at the level, it was still huge, but if you look at the second derivative, it was getting a little bit of a fiscal drag. You know, for better or worse, I think we've avoided that fiscal drag by spending our way into high growth. So I spent a lot of time looking at the daily treasury statement to look at, okay, where is the money coming in and where is it being spent? One area that I pay a lot of attention to, I think matters for the long term, is healthcare spending. And then you can look at the government base for healthcare for two big groups of people, the old, the Medicare and the veterans, the VA. That spending is up 15% over last year. And, you know, we're talking, you know, $1 trillion programs here.
Is that using a method of real collection of how much people are spending, or is that using the very, very flawed CPI measure of corporate profit?
Precisely. So that's why I started looking into that stuff, because I was getting frustrated at that, you know, okay, how does a CPI do it? How does a PC do it? The retained earnings method and you have all these issues in the way healthcare inflation is computed, which led, by the way, to healthcare in the CPI being negative last year, which is a joke, right? I mean, if you talk about, you know, anyone who pays insurance premium, I mean, it went up like crazy. I mean, car insurance premium went up by 20%, and then the BLS tells you cost of health insurance fell by 30%. That's what they said last year. Crazy, right? So I was getting frustrated with that. For a while, I thought, okay, I built an alternative CPI by using veterinarians, saying, okay, you know what, a dog is, you know, functionally the same as a human. So let's put that instead. And I'm like, well, I thought maybe that was not the best. So then I thought, well, we can see. I mean, the government paid. At the end of the day, what matters is not what the BLS records. It's the money that's in the economy, right? The doctors are being paid. The nurses are being paid. The hospitals are being paid. That money's going to circulate and, you know, be passed around. So I looked at these lines in the day treasury statement, and so Medicare and VA spending is up by 15%, and I think this is kind of a structural story because the cost of healthcare. I mean, we can have a whole conversation about how the healthcare system works or does not work in the U.S., but there is even a structural aspect about the way people die, unfortunately. You know, like 50 years ago, you worked all your life. Maybe you were in a coal mine or whatever, and you had a heart attack, and boom, you were gone, and that was over. Now that we are healthier, we are a lot more likely to die from a cognitive disease that take 10 years and require a lot of very expensive drugs, treatment, and attention. I mean, if you have Alzheimer's, if you have Parkinson, I mean, people can live for 10 years in a state of complete dependency. And this is a cost that, you know, as the boomers die and age, is going to explode. And I think we are starting to see the beginning of that. And that's going to really put insane pressure on inflation. I mean, just think about it. Now in the US, if you get PCE, I think healthcare is around 18% of PCE. And let's say that that number is the new normal, the 15% number I was talking about. So almost 20% of the economy growing at 15% rate. That's a 2% target right there.
Okay, so Vincent, I'll take your word for it. And I do believe that what you said is correct, that the stated deflation or very low rates of inflation in the consumer price index for healthcare, which you said is 18% of the CPI consumer price index.
PC,
18% of PCE. Thank you. That is too low. I mean, no one actually thinks that there was, you know, health insurance, the price of health insurance went down by 30% last year. That's clearly inaccurate. But isn't, in the same way that is stating a far too low price of inflation in healthcare, isn't, you know, shelter, which is 33% of CPI, I don't know what it is for PCE, isn't that way, way too high because people are still measuring from far? Okay, you're not, for people listening to the podcast, you're shaking your head. CPI is still measuring rental increases that happened in 2022 and 2023. And also, I've heard from multiple people in the real estate industry that, you know, if it says that the price of rent has gone up by 10%, oftentimes, that's just to make it look to the banks and, you know, investors that rates are still going up, that basically, oh, they'll, quote, raise your, quote, rent by 10%, but they'll give you 2 free months off. So actual real rent and shelter costs might even be going down. I mean, some people say that, I mean, and I'm talking about like actual real estate people who are on the ground, think that there's, you know, in some markets, shelter deflation, rent deflation, rather than inflation, which I'm sure, you know, is a relief for renters in that area. So what do you say to that?
Basically, the delayed impact of rate hikes, I think, is what we're getting at, right? It's the Fed started hiking 18 months ago, and then that took rents down. But shelter in the CPI rent is measured on the stock, and you don't roll over all your rents every year. So you reflect whatever changed happened with about a 1 year lag. I think that's the argument. So there are two kinds of them. One is if you look at the Zillow rent index, which is the marginal, the cost of the marginal rent, the market based one, it's actually never went negative year over year. And it's stabilized around 4%. So even then, what deflation are we pricing? At most, what we saw was a slowdown in the pace of increase. So disinflation to 4%, which, if I'm not mistaken, is twice our inflation target. That's in the Zillow rent index. Second, is the lag that we accumulated since COVID. So since COVID, the Zillow rent index goes up like crazy, and then shelter stays constant. So we're about 15-20% point below that. So as we, that mechanism of rolling over to the new rent first needs to catch you up before we start, you know, pricing this somewhat elusive disinflation in rent. So my point is, you know, okay, we're 200 yards behind. Like, yeah, you talk about a slowdown. That's first, let's catch up with the dude, and then, you know, maybe we'll slow down with him. But we're behind at this point, so needs to accelerate to catch up. And then the third one goes to how are rents set, like anything else, you know, supply and demand, of course, and which is pretty good, I would argue, from the perspective of the landlord, because people can't buy homes, right? So you have a lot of people who would have otherwise bought a home when they're renting. Construction has slowed because interest rates have increased. So it's a good market to be a landlord. That's the supply and demand side. And then there is the cost plus method. You know, if I own a house and I'm going to put on the market, I'm going to look at how much it costs for electricity, maintenance, water, tenant insurance, loan care, whatever. And you look at all these costs, they're rising by 4-5%. Why are they rising by 4-5%? Because again, structural inflation in the US is around 4-5%. This is where wage growth are. This is where everything, to me, everything points to the 4-5% number. So I don't believe you can have disinflation in rent if the cost of owning and maintaining a building is going up by 5%. Basically, what you're saying is, not you personally, but what people are saying is that the landlords are suddenly like St. Paul on his way to Damascus, see the light, and oh my, here goes my margin. Let me do a good deed and help a tenant out and destroy my margin. that doesn't happen.
And you think demand, not only demand is obviously people want, you know, nice places to live. Like the demand for ultra luxury buildings is always extremely high by everyone, but it's just that costs a lot of money, and you know, not everyone has that money. So you think the ability of renters to pay significant increases is still high because you're such a bull on the economy?
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, I live in the Bay, San Francisco Bay Area, and I mean, it's weird. You know, it's the tale of two cities, where the time of light, the time of darkness. I mean, you see the you know, the commercial real estate. You know, people have not come back to the office. You see the junkies, the feces in the street, the homeless problem. But at the same time, you also see people who worked at, you know, NVIDIA for 5 years and, you know, got basically millions of dollars in stock-based compensation. People who were at, you know, Facebook last year and got all these stock options issued when the stock was down and now have a lot of cash. And these people are like, yeah, I'm going to buy a house or I'm going to rent a higher place. So we can't have, that's where the cognitive dissonance sets in, is we can't have at the same time, a disaster in commercial real estate and downtowns that look at ghost town, increasing rents and cost of shelter keeps going up.
And so I'm sorry, just so the Zillow rent index, you said it's gone down from about 15% to, you said it's now at what?
3.5% year over year.
3.5%. Yeah. Okay. Got it. That's what mine said. So yeah, I wonder if that takes into account the giving people the free months off rent factor. But okay, so that 3.5%. So that's huge deflation from 16%, but it's still above the target. Yes. Well above the target.
Yes, yes.
So what do you think that means for the Federal Reserve's interest rates path? Currently, the spot for upper range for is at 5.5% for the Fed funds rate. Going into this year, I think 6 interest rates cuts were priced, meaning 4% by the end of the year. Now, I didn't even check today, but it's 1 to 2, yeah, right?
1.4, I think, yeah.
1.4 cuts, yeah. Which camp are you in? How many times do you think the Federal Reserve will cut this year or ever, or, you know, in the cycle?
0 to 1, or 1 and then a hike after that, would be my guess.
Wow.
For the longest time, I mean, what this was like, you know, eating candy, whatever the saying, that, I mean, like the market kept pricing these rate cuts, you know, and it's like, why? I mean,
Vincent, I'd say it might have been candy, you know, last year or definitely in 2022 when the market was always pricing in these cuts and the Federal Reserve was just
right,
like spelling it out, like in a, you know, in a way that a baby could understand, that we're going to hike more and more and more, you know, the bank crisis that ultimately did not have a huge impact on the economy, that, you know, that might have slowed it, but it didn't. But this time around, the interest rate rally, the fall in interest rates from November to January was specifically blessed by the Federal Reserve. So why, it wasn't kind of candy. Right. I mean, I remember definitely it was my view, you know, that 5 were priced in and the Fed had put 3 on the dot plot.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the Fed has committed to 3. Again, it's not a commitment with 3, but when Jay Powell says he's going to do right, something or indicates that he may do something, he likes to follow through. He doesn't like to lead the market on.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I think historians will go back to that period and wonder what was happening at the Fed that back then. I wondered at the time too. I was like, I mean, are they aware of something that I'm not? I mean, especially when we started to get this bad inflation print January, February, and the Fed was just ignoring it. I mean, the way I rationalize it is it's the story then suddenly. Basically, the Fed did not have any special data that suggested growth for inflation was falling. You're just cool with it. And I was just like, hey, man, I'm not gonna raise the Fed funds rate to 6-7%. You know, I'm gonna take the win and then declare mission accomplished and let the stock market run and then let inflation run hot. I mean, that's the only way I can make sense of the Fed behavior throughout. Now, going back to your question, so yeah, I was saying it was very easy before. You just bet against it. You know, about 2 months ago, there was, I think, at 1.7 rate cuts. I mean, the Fed was guiding at most for 3. And it was not even clear it was between 3 and 2 in the summary of economic projection. So, I mean, they were still pretty high, the market. Now it's gone back to, 1.5. But again, I mean, let's look at, you know, how many months are left in the year, how many meetings. So, May, clearly, we're not going to be able to do it because, even today, the wage data come in or whatever, like, you know, way too high. June, I mean, you need a lot of really good things to happen so that you can make the case for June. So that really just leaves July and September into play, because then after that, you get November just after the election. You can get into politics after that, but, you know, I don't think you cut right after the election, especially if I believe we have a very inflationary outcome. So, yeah, so you basically have two meetings that are in play. So my guess is...
Which meetings are in play?
July, September,
yeah.
And there's this theory, I don't know how much I buy it, that you don't want to do July because it's between the conventions. I don't know. More likely to me is going to be like, you don't want to do July because the data is not going to help you. But I also worry that the data is just going to keep not helping you. So at some point, I think, you know, if I agree with you that Powell kind of likes to, you know, maintain consistency and do what he says and say what he do and not be bullied by the market. So yeah, maybe he'll feel it. They cornered themselves by having all these idiots go out and say, oh, we need to cut blah, blah, blah. Now there's a credibility problem. So maybe they need to do one, but then if they do one, I think it'll be a hawkish cut, right? It's not the beginning of a rate cut cycle. We don't know what the direction of the next move is going to be. Which would be kind of stupid, honestly. I mean, if you mess up, it's probably better to just admit you mess up. But the way I think about that 2024 cut will be like the 2008 hike by Jean-Claude Trichet, where, you know, he hiked just as the world economy was entering depression, and he hiked just because he said he was going to do it. And then a month later, obviously, he had to cut. I think we're going to have the same, but the other way around.
So even though it's true Powell likes to follow through on his word when he signals something to markets, he also definitely does not like to be seen as political. And having the first interest rate cut be in November, right before the election, would definitely be seen by some, not necessarily as a politically biased move. So you think that, the Federal Reserve will do 0 to 1, and will that cut be after the election or before? Sorry if I didn't, you already said that.
I guess before.
Before, okay.
Yeah, like July or September meeting, and then maybe undo. Well, it'd be kind of a nasty sign. I don't remember the Fed meeting. I think it's a day after the election. The election is November 4, and the Fed meeting is the 6 or something like that.
It is November 7th, and the election date is November 5th.
Okay. I don't know the optics of that, but, you know, my guess is Trump's going to win it, and then we'll have a whole different talk about inflation then.
Why do you think Trump is going to win the U.S. presidential election?
Because I have eyes.
Because you have eyes. Okay.
I mean, it's not endorsement. You know, when you talk about politics in this podcast, you always get the comment section like, don't. I'm not a Trump guy, okay? Like, I'm not political. I'm whatever. I don't vote in this country, okay? So, I'm just looking at the polls and the, you know, I'm thinking, oh my God, we're gonna have debates. You know, how is that gonna look?
That is a fair point. I think maybe I am overrating how much the economy matters in an election, because no matter what happens, Trump is going to say the economy is horrible and Biden's going to say the economy is great. And Republicans are going to agree with Trump and Democrats are going to agree with Biden, no matter what. But if the economy stays hot and there's no recession, wouldn't the Biden's case of we had the strongest growth in history, again, that's because it was coming out of the COVID recession. So it was all of base effects. But, you know, inflation has fallen like a rock. Don't you think those arguments would, you know, whether or not they resonate with people, but they would make sense if we don't have a recession?
Yeah, intellectually, I agree with you. Yeah. You know, I'm the high nominal growth guy. Wages are growing. Yes, I agree with
unemployment
that.
Rate below 4%. Yeah,
right. But it's not lending, and I think the reason it's not lending, there's a condescending element to it, which is, you know, who are you going to believe? You're lying on I or my expert here? And people don't want to trust the experts after COVID. And yeah, inflation has hurt them. And yeah, for whatever reason, that argument is not landing. It hasn't landed. I mean, you could have made it for a long time. I mean, it's you know, we're supposed to be in recession right now. I mean, it should be a huge win, but it's not landing at all. So I'm not sure how that's going to change in 6 months, especially if as I believe, inflation picks up again.
Yeah, so asset markets definitely react to, I guess, second derivative, the rate of change of inflation. So it falling from 9% to 3% is insanely bullish for the stock market, or has been. But from, you know, most people's perspective, prices are 20% higher than before COVID. And yeah, they think as long as they stay 20% higher, i.e. zero inflation, there's still inflation because, you know, things still cost more.
Yeah. And also, again, people don't buy the CPI. Okay. They don't buy the shelter CPI. They don't buy the health insurance CPI that dropped by 30%. They don't see owner's equivalent rent. Yeah. So the reason I was going into politics was not to kind of start a, I don't know, who's horse races to who's going to win. But if we go by my, which is not, I know it's just what the polls are saying. You look at the polling in swing states, which is where the election is decided. It's leaning very clearly for Trump. So if Trump wins, my point is going to be a massive inflationary shock, because you're going to have tariffs, 10% across the board tariff, 50% tariff on China. And that was the part that really helped your disinflation, was the core goods, right? Clearing of the supply chain, all that. This is why we no longer have 9% inflation, right? It's because we can buy stuff from China again. Well, let's say we take that off, that goes back up. And then closing the border. One thing that tremendously helped last year was we had 4 million people, largest population immigration in the U.S. in the history of the nation, 4 million people. At a time when this is exactly what we needed, right? I mean, after COVID, basically U.S. population, working age, labor force shrank by 6 million people. You had 2 million people who retired early, 2 million people who had long COVID, disability, all these weird things that happened with COVID, went part-time, started working from their phone in Bali or whatever. And then another 2 million that did not come in because the border was closed. So that's why we couldn't find waiters, roofers, truck drivers. And then 2023 comes, and here we go. We get 6 million working age people across, 4 million. So that basically filled the gap. But even with that, we have 3.5% unemployment rate, 5% growth in labor costs. So that what this tells me is that the labor market is still red hot. And the moment we close that southern border, we're going to be back exactly where we were in 2022 when we couldn't, you know, get our hands on labor. So Trump will be massively inflationary, which is why I doubt that the Fed will cut in November or December if, as I expect, Trump wins the election.
The narrative is, or Republicans like to talk about how they are the party of fiscal responsibility. You know, they also run deficits, but you think Trump won't cut programs and he might even cut taxes more, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to think. Again, we can use our eyes here. You know, he's been president for 4 years. Before Biden, that was the, you know, this is the first time we're running $1 trillion deficit at a time of full employment and a very strong economy back then. You know, we had the big tax cuts. We had, you know, a lot of spending. Didn't touch Medicare or Medicaid. And again, I mean, demographically, politically, you know, if you look at the median age of the Republican voter, I mean, these people can read a chart, okay? Like, they're not going to cut Social Security given their
yeah. Oh, yeah. No.
Okay. So that's where this. Okay, where is your spending coming from? Social Security and then military spending. Republicans rarely cut military. Although I would say Trump on that is probably a little bit better than some of the kind of neocon, but still in general, you don't expect the Republicans to cut down military spending. So it's not going to come down. Trump's going to do tax cuts. I mean, because that's what he loves. So, I mean, I laugh when you say that the party of fiscal responsibility. I mean, go run on that platform. I mean, this has died. Like, you have, you know, there's no party of fiscal responsibility.
Yeah, and, you know, Vincent, on this show, I normally try and avoid politics. But, I mean, if we're living in an age of fiscal dominance and it is Congress, not the Federal Reserve, that is, you know, a prime mover of inflation and growth, we kind of have to talk about it. Even though optically you turn on CNN or Fox News, Republicans and Democrats are, you know, not getting along at all. And they squabble, you know, and are much more rude to each other than in the 1990s, the golden age, the 1980s when they were compromised. It seems like actually when it comes to passing bills, they actually get a lot of stuff done and they pass a lot of bills and print a lot of money to do it.
Yeah, and that money is still in the economy. I mean, even if we don't add any new spending, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why growth is so resilient is because we had the COVID money, then we had the bipartisan infrastructure bill, then we had the Inflation Reduction Act, then we had the CHIPS Act. I mean, you know, a trillion here and a trillion there, and soon you start talking about real money, right? And that kind of money, you know, you vote $1 trillion bill, really what you're doing is you're spending $100 billion for 10 years. So that's still, I think that's the reason why, like, if you look at the non-residential construction spending in the U.S., it's going through the roof. Is again, fiscal policy, I mean, we talk about the long and variable, right? You know, for monetary policy, it's so long and so variable that it doesn't even exist. but for fiscal policy, the long and variable, like, lags exist. So that stimulative effect from the big, you know, as you pointed, often bipartisan bills that we had in the past 4 years is going to be with us for the rest of the decade. And I'm not counting all the new stuff that's going to come.
So, Vincent, in an era of secularly higher inflation, people think of an inflation hedge. They think of gold. Perhaps if they're, you know, on the younger side, they might think of Bitcoin. You actually, you know, maybe, I don't know, I think you like gold. Your number one solution that you like the most is actually inflation break-evens and actually, like, being long inflation itself as an asset. Explain why that's the case, as well as some very interesting back tests you've done on how that portfolio compares to the 60-40.
You know, let me go back a little bit as to tying on the macro with the portfolio construction. So, you know, we've lived in a world, you know, where the best thing you could do is go all passive and do 60-40. And then that portfolio, I mean, for all the time that you and I have been alive, it has done very well. And the reason it's done very well, it was a naturally balanced portfolio. You had when your growth asset stocks, the 60 was for growth, and then your recession asset, the 40, especially the long-term treasury. So, you know, and then you use some leverage on top of that, you know, and you made an all-weather portfolio, right? The risk
barrier. Wait a minute, sorry, Vincent, let me explain for the audience is that in the recession, stocks would do badly, but bonds would do well because the Federal Reserve would cut interest rates and there'd be a demand for a safe asset. And so yields would fall, prices of bonds would go up. So it would balance.
Well, 08, you know, your stocks are down 50%. I mean, long-term treasury were up 40%. So 60-40 was maybe down only 15%. And that was beautiful. Like, it was naturally balanced. Now, if I'm right about recessions have become impossible, basically, that's what's my macro thesis, which may or may not look very bad in a couple of years. You don't need to hedge against a risk that no longer exists. So what's that 40? What's that maybe 20% treasury? What is that doing to your portfolio? Not much, really, especially now that it's positively correlated with stocks. So it adds to the volatility, and then, you know, look at a chart of TLT. That thing just goes down every day. So it's return-free risk at this point. So you need to hedge for a risk that is actually likely to happen, which, if I'm right, that we're going to have this economy constantly above potential because of constant fiscal stimulation and accommodative monetary policy, because I do believe monetary policy is accommodative, the risk is you lose your handle on inflation. Instead of having this nice world of, like, 4% inflation that I believe you get a, you know, another spike to 7-8. So you need to find an asset that will do the job there. So typical inflation hedge, you go in the book, it's gold, Bitcoin, commodities, emerging markets, short the dollar, whatever. And I ran it, looked at the performance of these things. Again, the City Inflation Surprise Index, which basically is an index of how hot inflation is compared to consensus. And none of these things work. Why is that? Because these things don't pay dividends. When you have high inflation, typically you start pricing rate hikes. So the value of a non-dividend paying asset drops. I mean, you know, people make the joke that, you know, Bitcoin is 3x on NASDAQ. And sometimes trade like that. And I like both Bitcoin and gold. But, you know, gold also. I mean, over the long term, yes, gold works as an inflation hedge, but on a day-to-day basis, it's not so great. Same thing with emerging market stocks. Same thing with being short the dollar. So there's only one thing that I thought worked was to be long TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Security, and short TLT, long-term treasuries. So effectively, a synthetic position in the break-even.
So you're long the market's expectations or the market's pricing of inflation. So I don't, let's just say that the break-even, inflation break-even is 2%, that means that the market is pricing in 2% inflation in the future.
Yes. What I like about this trade is when you long TIPS, you long two things. You long inflation and real rates. And these things can hurt you bad. Like last year, inflation was very high, but tips did horribly because real rates went up. So you need to sterilize this. And the way you do this is by shorting treasuries at the same time. So you just long that inflation component. The other nice thing about the trade is that it's got positive carry, because right now inflation is high. So tips yield higher than treasuries. So it's something that gives you money. A little bit, not a lot, of course, but you know, 1 or 2% more. And then the last part, and this is something I need to give credit where credit is due, Kevin Muir, the macro tourist, you know, he showed me, Vincent, like, run the chart, look at the correlation of the 60-40. Oh my God, this thing is so, I do it with long TIP, short TLT. So I have a bit more volatility in it, because the duration is not perfectly matched, right? TIP has 6-year duration, TLT has 20. So effectively, I'm short 13 years of duration, which I want. I mean, I want that because I believe, you know, curves are going to steepen and stuff like that. But if you just want the pure bet, there's a Bloomberg, it's called a Bloomberg 10-year break-even strategy. Oh my God, this thing is so boring. It's so beautiful. I mean, since COVID just goes up steadily, like, you know, 6% a year, zero volatility, negative correlation to 60-40. It's doing exactly what long-term treasury used to do during the 2010s. A boring asset that has a negative correlation, positive expected return and negative correlation of the 60-40 portfolio. This is what you want to replace your long-term treasuries.
Very interesting. Sounds like that would be a little bit intermediate to advanced in terms of putting stuff on, because the more easy way to do it would be to short TLT and go long tips. The more advanced way would be to, like, be long the breaking even itself or a CPI swap, but obviously that's something for institutional investors. So Vincent, what if someone they don't have a ISDA agreement, you know, they don't want to short something, and they want to have something that's very vanilla in the investment world, the world of equities and bonds? What portfolio allocation do you think makes sense there?
Well, so the first thing is, I mean, if you can't short at least zero, right, get rid of the long term treasuries part of your portfolio.
Yeah,
like this, you know, get rid of that. And then the question is, what do you put against it? I mean, I would put some cash. I love cash. You know, cash pays 5.5%. That's more than investment grade debt. So, you know, corporate bonds don't give you pay you for credit or duration risk. So that there's a solid argument for just having a lot of cash. I think there's a solid argument also to have a long, I mean, again, I don't know how retail your retail guy is. Can your retail guy take a long position in the dollar index, or is he?
Let's say hypothetically, yes, sure.
All right, good. So then if he can, he goes long the dollar index. Why does he do that? First, because it has the same property as that tips, that break-even trade I was mentioning. Positive carry, because when you long the dollar index, you're, you know, long the dollar at 5.5% policy rate versus Japan and Europe, which is well below. So you have positive carry. And negative correlation to the 60-40 portfolio. If you look at the rolling correlation between the 60-40 and the dollar index since COVID, it's consistently been negative. No other asset has done that other than my break-even strategy, but you told me I'm not allowed to use it. So,
But Vincent, isn't being long the dollar something, a recession hedge? Because when there's a recession, everyone scrambles for the dollar. Isn't that a hedge that, you know, if there's no recession, you don't need that hedge?
Because I think that it's kind of you heard the term dollar smile. Same idea, right? So the argument works the other way as well, right? I mean, if things are really good, which is what I'm talking about, like growth is really high, you also want to be long the dollar, because, you know, at the end of the day, the Fed still, for all its flaws, the US still has a much better ability to withstand higher rates than Europe. And it's a lot, and that's what the dollar index is. At the end of the day, that euro cross. I mean, you had euro, Swiss, pound, and Swedish krona, whatever. You're probably looking at 80 plus percent of the dollar index, right? So, I think the biggest risk is that inflation and growth is hotter than people want in the U.S. The Fed doesn't cut. That puts the ECB in a bind, that puts certainly the Bank of Japan in a bind, and the dollar keeps getting stronger. So we talked about dropping the long-term treasuries, having some cash, having some dollar index, and then, I mean, they're improper, but they're not they're imperfect, but they're not bad. I mean, gold over long periods of time is a good hedge against inflation, especially if I believe Bitcoin for you know, for whichever your, I have no religion here, whatever you prefer, is more or less the same case. Basically negative real rates, right? I mean, if I'm right that we're going to need 10 years of negative real rates to work through all this debt in the system, an asset that, you know, keeps its real value but doesn't pay a dividend and a scarcity value is going to do well.
But I want to ask you about sectoral analysis within the equity market and equity allocation in general. So you talked about the dollar index. Most of it's the euro, but a little piece of it is the Japanese yen, which has melted down relative to the dollar as, you know, Bank of Japan interest rates are basically still at zero, right, and the Fed interest rates in the US are so much higher. How much further do you think it goes, and why?
I'm not in the head of the people at the Bank of Japan and the Ministry of Finance, but I suspect they must be having a tough time right now. I think what they were betting on, which is what the market was betting on, is that they'd get bailed out by the Fed. Right. Okay. They kept basically this legacy policy of ZIRP and yield curve control. It was really stretched. Oh my God, we're going to 150. They kind of defended 150 for a bit, thinking, okay, I just have a couple more months. I have the reserves to do it. And then the Fed's going to cut. And now it's like, damn, the Fed is not going to cut. Like, what is it that I do? Do I defend 160? Okay. But the problem with defending it is, you know, you're back. You know, 2 months later, you had defending 170. Because the problem is not buying yen overnight against the dollar. It's the rates, right? I mean, it's very hard to have, you know, maintain 0% policy when the risk-free rate is 5.5% and stays there.
Absolutely. Over the past 2 years, that's been the case. The interest rates in Japan have been negative or zero. And the Federal Reserve, you know, U.S. interest rates much higher, so the yen devalues. That makes sense. But hasn't, since like 1990, interest rates in Japan been super low relative to high interest rates around the rest of the world? And the yen, in some cases, strengthened, right? Like, Japan has been able to defy economic gravity for so long. Why do you think that gravity is going to, you know, still be, you know, be a thing, just because it has been a thing over the past 2 years?
The carry trade typically in Japan was with things like you know, Indonesia, Thailand. I mean, you had some Japanese institutions buying treasuries for sure. But I think that now what's different is, if I'm right, is a perception that the U.S. is just breaking out with, you know, higher rates forever. And also there's maybe Japan's at these really high, you know, kept producing these large trade surpluses, which in a way kind of offset, I mean, not in a way, accounting wise, you know, the trade balance offset the capital balance. So you were losing on the capital balance as yens were leaving, but you were winning back on the trade balance. I think one big difference is the trade balance is degrading for Japan because of the energy shock. You know, I mean, Japan was very reliant on exports from Russia, which is a lot harder for them to get now with the sanctions. So they're having an energy shock. And at the same time, they're faced with, you know, they used to be the world's largest car exporter. Now it's China.
Yeah.
So that's degradation in trade balances. And then in a weird way, that a weak yen maybe makes that worse. I mean, then that I think that's the hard conversation that must be going on at the Ministry of Finance, the BOJ. Is like, can we really run an advanced industrial economy when the price of copper increasing by 30% a month, when, you know, the price of gold doubles in 2 years in yen terms? That's starting to bite quite a bit. These are all questions, I think, for that must be really interesting between the Ministry of Finance and the BOJ. But as far as U.S. investors, doesn't really matter. I think that the answer is to just own Japanese stocks in yen terms.
Own Japanese stocks in yen terms, not dollar terms.
Yeah. The point, you own them in local currency. Like, you don't hedge the currency. And then here let me explain. So I have no idea what they're going to do. Part of me tells me they should revalue. I think they will revalue, but You know, they could have revalued at 120, 130, 140, 150, and they haven't.
You're talking about 150 yen to the one US dollar. Yeah.
Right. If they don't, if they let the yen kind of, you know, trade like a Turkish lira, the Nikkei is a new Istanbul Stock Exchange, which has performed fantastically well. Over the past 4 years, Turkish stocks in dollar term have been one of the best performing market, better than NASDAQ. Why is that? Because, you know, if you decide to trash a currency, you're subsidizing your exporters. Every month, you allow them to pay their employees monkey money and they earn hard currency. Japan has some very nice exporters, you know. I mean, you look at your Nikkei, I mean, you have them, you know, very, very good name. Then, and you've seen the Nikkei go up pretty much every day for a long time. So you keep doing that. And then conversely, if at some point Ministry of Finance, Bank of Japan agree on, okay, we let go of yield curve control, we stop QE, we can't do this, you know, inflation is too hot, whatever. Then I think you see the yen just, we could go back to 100 overnight. I mean, for me, my template is what the Swiss did. You know, the Swiss in
2015,
right? So they were pegging to the euro, and then the euro was, you know, obviously Eurozone was a basket case. The Swiss economy, just Swiss franc wanted to appreciate. They kept it with negative rates and all that stuff. And then one day they just let go. And overnight, it shot up by like 30%. And this is one thing that, I mean, a lot of economists have written about that, the Dornbusch over-adjustment theory, overshooting of the exchange rate. When you have a shock, exchange rates typically overshoot. So my idea is that overshoot is going to be bigger than the adjustment in the Nikkei. Of course, when that happens, the Japanese stock market is going to drop, but you're going to make more on being long yen than you will lose on being long Nikkei.
Right. So currencies has always been a weak spot in, you know, my kind of macro arsenal. But I think, so what you want to be long is the chart of the Nikkei priced in Japanese yen, in the same way that gold priced in Japanese yen has been incredibly bullish, much more so bullish than...
It's the Nikkei in dollar.
Yeah. No. So you want to be long the Nikkei in...
Basically just EWJ.
What?
EWJ.
Hedge. You want to hedge. Exactly. You
EWJ, the non-hedge, the iShare one, the non-hedge.
Okay.
Because my view, even in dollar terms, even on EK, even with yen depreciation, you're still making money. Like that's the Turkish argument. Like you made money in Turkish stocks in dollar term. And indeed, Japanese stocks in dollar term have done well, even though the yen has lost a lot of value. So you keep that. If nothing changes, you're happy with that. You just take that. And then if something breaks down, then the yen is going to go up more than the Nikkei is going to come down. So your total return as a dollar-based investor is going to be positive on that day. While if you are a Japanese yen investor, you're going to get smoked.
Got it. Okay. So there's two ETFs, EWJ and DWJ. So DWJ is the hedged one.
Yes.
And that has smoked EWJ. Because EWJ has gone up. But just not as much as DWJ, because DWJ, you're long. It's as if you're a Japanese investor, but you think that that won't continue. So you're kind of a yen bull.
I don't know if I think that. I'm just saying that in that hedge position, the reason you're making so much money on the hedge position is you're dancing on a volcano.
Yes.
and maybe that doesn't blow and you keep partying and you make money, but that part of that return in the hedge ETF is the risk that one day, and we don't know when that day will be, you'll see the yen go up by 50% and the Nikkei go down by 20%. And keep in mind that with that ETF, you long the thing that goes down and short the thing that goes up.
Yes.
So, and it compounds. So in one day, you're going to lose 50% at least. With the other one, these two will move. So yes, it's lagged, but it's my point. Even though it's lagged, it's still good. Like I think probably performed as well as SPY over the past couple of years. And then when that accident happens, you'll have the hedge of the currency working for you instead of against you.
Got it. That makes sense. So Vincent, what do you think about the Bank of Japan raising interest rates? I think one thing, probably one of the most common, you know, said shibboleths in macro is the Bank of Japan can't raise interest rates because there's too much debt. I believe in our last conversation, I brought that up to you and you actually said, why is that the case? So much of the government of Japan's debt is owned by the Bank of Japan, which is basically, you know, if you think a central bank is part of the government, which, you know, in some ways it kind of is, yeah. It owns itself. So it cancels out so that it could. Do you think the Bank of Japan will raise interest rates? And I mean, are we talking what, to 50 basis points, or will they actually get to a reasonable, you know, non-ridiculous level?
My answer is I think they will eventually. Again, it's the whole, now it's getting to the point that the slowly versus suddenly part. I think Japan is a case where, you know, it was happening slowly before, and I was fine. Like, the economy had time to adjust. But now when you see, like I said, the price of copper up 30% a couple of months, again, Japan is not Costa Rica. Japan is an advanced industrial economy that imports a lot of raw materials. And you can't manage this volatility on a day-to-day basis. At some point, you have to be serious. You're the third largest economy in the world. I mean, you can't run it like it's, you know, Argentina or something. I think that happens. And yes, I agree with you that I'm not convinced with the debt argument, because so much of the debt is owned by the Bank of Japan. I mean, basically, that was the goal of the past. The 20 years of policy was basically to move these awful JGBs from the pension sector to the central bank, because the pension sector, they take a hit and they can't pay the pensions. The central bank takes the hit while it prints money. So, we're pretty far advanced. I mean, I don't remember the exact number, but the difference between the gross debt to GDP, which includes the holding of the BOJ, and the net is huge. Probably the gross is around 200%. The net, maybe even under 100%. So on a net basis, you may have less public, like truly public debt in Japan. I mean, my view is you should consolidate, you know, central bank. I mean, this and government debt, because, you know, if I own liability, if I own an asset or claim on myself, I owe nothing. So if you do that, Japan is not abnormal. If anything, it's abnormal in the sense that the private sector has very little debt. So I would, the public sector is not abnormally indebted, and the private sector is relatively debt-free. So that's what I meant when I said Japan probably can withstand high interest rates more than people think.
Yes, but again, that's canceling out the huge amount of public debt that's owned by the Bank of Japan, BOJ. If you don't cancel that out, the Japanese debt to GDP is, of course, huge, as people say. Vincent, final topic for you. Within the equity world, you know, so, okay, I have to invest in stocks. Which sectors do you like? What types of investment styles do you like? And why in this inflationary, no recession future that you envision?
The way I think about inflation and disinflation is a transfer between producers and consumers, ultimately, right? So when you have disinflation, you're transferring wealth from producers to consumers. Oh, you're paying less for gas, so you're going to spend more on Amazon, and you're going to do that house renovation project or whatever. Conversely, inflation is the opposite, right? So you move up the value chain. So I think for the past, you know, 40 years, the trade has to be go down, go close, you know, and indeed, technology, which is a downstream sector, consumer discretionary have been performed fantastically well, while the upstream sector, energy, basic material, industrials have lagged. So if we move into secular inflation, you want to move upstream again, because these are the companies that will preserve their margin. And by preserving their margin, they destroy the margins of the people who buy from them. So there's that at the sector level. And then there's, at least in the same direction, there's a duration argument also. When you have high inflation, eventually it means the cost, the future is more uncertain. So there's a more, you put a bigger premium on having, you know, things you can touch. And also at some point when the market eventually prices it out, yield curves are going to steepen, long-term yield, short-term yields have already moved. So if you're a short-duration asset, you're already living in that 5% world. But long-duration stocks are not in that 5% world yet. So when you reprice, that will hurt them, and they earn most of their value from the far future, which get discounted at a higher rate when you have high inflation. So short-duration sectors puts you back, again, the same that I was talking about, more of the value type of sectors.
So Vincent, I'm going to push you a little bit on this. So duration, you know, is interest rate sensitivity. And when in the fixed income world of bonds, it is mechanical. A 10-year treasury note, if yield on it rises, mechanically, the price is going to go down. That will always be true no matter what you say, unless you change the definition, which of course, it never will be a change. The world of equities though, you know, in 2021 and 2022, especially, okay, when interest rates went up and bond yields spiked higher, bond prices fell mechanically. NVIDIA went down, Apple went down, Google went down, all these long duration Tesla stocks went down. But that really was just a specific regime, and hasn't been true that for the since the low in October 2022, we've had a rally in long duration stocks, even as interest rates have stayed high or even marginally gone higher. So, you know, do you acknowledge the fact that that correlation has really broken down? And is there a reason why you think it will return at a certain level if bond yields go to 6%, say?
I'm going to go back. You know, I said, you know, you started with seeing bonds, you increase the discount rate, net present value goes down. What's the difference between a stock and a bond is there's an extra term in your discount rate in stocks is G, right? So for a bond, you get your cash flow, you discount by 1 plus R, and then you get your net present value. There's nothing else. For stocks, you discount by R minus G, the difference between the cost of capital and the rate of growth of said cash flow. I think what happened in the past 6 months from September, whatever that low was, to March, was R went up, but G went up even more, right? This was the market realizing some of the things that I've been saying for a long time, that the growth is higher than people think, and we're not going to have this recession. So, and as inflation was soaring at the same time, R was not really moving, and G was coming back up. I think that's what was happening. And so I guess what you're telling me is there a scenario where R and G move together higher, right? Which is actually kind of what we've been talking about, right? This kind of secular growth story. Yeah, I can get behind that. That's one of the reasons why I wouldn't be underweight stocks, and I haven't been recommending that either. Stocks are growth assets, claim on real cash flow. Now, within the portfolio, I still think just because of the way yield curves are, most of the brunt, I think the G is pretty high right now, the implied G, and then the R still reflects some of these rate cuts. You know, like if you look at long term, yield curve is still inverted, right? So if we see this steepening of the yield curve, mechanically, I think that that benefits companies that derive most of their value from the present. And I mean, you can think also of a high dividend stock. I mean, a stock that pays dividends, kind of high coupon bond, right? So you get to reinvest. If we are in this world of higher rates, higher growth, you want the money to be returned to you as fast as possible, because the opportunity to reinvest at a higher rate will be better instead of locking it up in a loss-making unicorn that may make money in 20 years.
Got it. Final question for Vincent. What do you think of the financial sector and like the banks as an investment? They had a little bit of a hiccup last year, as everyone knows, but if there's no recession ever, not that of course you're saying that, but I imagine financial stocks may do well.
Yeah. I mean, on that, I think you've really taken the lead there. I think that's the call you had, and I think that was a correct call. I don't spend enough time really looking at the banks. I think you had some great guests. Yeah, I think you made the right call that SVB was not going to be the end of the world, that credit cards or auto loans or all these things were not going to blow things up. And yeah, I mean, I can see banks, valuations are certainly not very high. I would put that in that general bucket of low duration, value sectors that benefit from this new era.
Definitely. But of course, with financials, it's much more than the macro. If Elizabeth Warren, says that banks are not allowed to have any leverage at all, not that, that's realistic, but, even in a great economy, those stocks wouldn't do well as well. Vincent, thanks so much for joining us. People can find you on Twitter at Vincent Deluard. I really recommend your work. You are, your written reports are extremely funny as well as informative, as well as obviously very thoughtful. They are also very entertaining, which, is hard to say about a lot of, economic research, especially about, sell side research written by the big banks. Where can people find the work that you do for StoneX?
So if you go to my Twitter handle, at Vincent Deluard, Vincent with T, and then Deluard, D-L-U-A-R-D, there's a pinned tweet, and then there is a link that will take you to a free trial of our research. So you'll get it for you know, I think 2 months, feel free to DM me if you know, for whatever reason you want more. And then for StoneX customers, it's very easy. Just talk to your brokers. We are obviously very big in commodities, futures. So institutional clients can get it there. And last is just follow me on, you know, podcasts. I mean, I love these conversations. I think every time we have a conversation, I come out with 100 new ideas and things I want to test. So I'm going to keep doing it.
I feel the same way. Thanks again, Vincent, and thanks everyone for listening. Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vanek.com/hodlfg to learn more about the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL.